Hello, welcome to Outdoors from Scotland. My name's John Burns, and this is my podcast for folk who like the outdoors. It's the beginning of November up here in the Highlands. Always a sort of exciting time, I think. We're right on the sort of doorstep of winter. And winter for me is always an exciting time in the hills. What kind of winter we get? Well, that's probably anybody's guess right now. But my guest today is here to talk about his new book, An Eye to the Hills, which has been described as a love letter to Scotland's wild places. My guest is a prolific writer. He was the editor of Footloose, Climber, The Great Outdoors, and has presented a number of TV shows, including The Adventure Show. He really needs no introduction by me. And he is, of course, Cameron McNeish. Hello, Cameron. How are you?
Hi, John. I'm great, man. Thank you.
Good, good. Now, I'm going to cheat here because what I'm going to do is when I read your book, one of the interesting things, right at the start of it, there's a list of books that you wrote. And one of your earliest books, I think, which really sounds a kind of piece of history in a way, was The Spur Book of Youth Hostling. Did you remember that one yourself?
I do remember it. Yeah, I think that was probably the first book or the second book or something I'd ever written. Yeah. I did spend, I think, 8 or 9 years running youth hostels. And there wasn't anything on the market at the time. And I had a friend called Rob Hunter, who had this company called Spur Books. And he talked me into writing a book about youth hostling. And at first I thought, what the hell can you say about youth hostling other than you go there, you pay your money and you put your head down for the night? But when I got into it, I realized there's actually quite a lot you can say about youth hostling. And it did quite well, that little book, yeah. But that was, my goodness, that must be the late 1970s, I think, that was published.
I thought it was great because it brought back to my mind the sort of era that where many people, when I was in the 70s, and my first contact with the hills and the outdoors, and for many people, really, was via youth hostling.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. And youth hostling has changed so much dramatically. Yeah. When I wrote that book, some of the hostels, you weren't allowed to arrive by car. You had to arrive by bike or on foot. Yeah. And you shared dormitories with a bunch of other guys. If you're a girl, you shared a female dormitory. You had to do a hostel duty every morning.
So that's right.
What can I do? What's my hostel duty? And if you're in a really foul mood, you got someone to clean the stoves or something, or go and get the coal or something like that. So it's kind of interesting. But of course, the downside to that is we didn't get any help in the hostel. You know, my wife and I had to run the place, had to clean it, had to decorate it. And what we used to do at first is some of the lads wanted to stay for a while. And climb. I'm talking about Aviemore Youth Hostel.
Where we were.
And they wanted to stay. And I think if I remember right, you were only allowed to stay so many nights. So we let some guys stay for free for a while, and they did all the big sort of decorating jobs for us and stuff. So yeah, there were ways around it, but it was great fun, and we met some wonderful people. And yeah. It's really what started me writing, John, because I found this old typewriter in the hostel. And you're really in the hostel, apart from the cleaning and whatnot, you really only have people to attend to first thing in the morning when they're leaving, and yes, after sort of 4 in the afternoon. So I had all day. So I started sort of typing out some little stories and whatnot. So it's where I started writing. So yeah, I've got a lot to be thankful to the Scottish Youth Hostels Association for. It was a fantastic experience at a time in our life when we kind of needed a bit of stability.
Yeah. Yeah, but it was a great introduction. I mean, you're obviously a member of that august body of folk, the youth hostel wardens, who were known and feared across the island.
I was chairman of the Scottish Youth Hostel.
Oh my God!
The Wardens Association, and one of my first achievements in that was getting an equal pay for the wives, because at that time you had to be a married couple to run a youth hostel.
I didn't know that. Is that right? Oh, okay.
But they only paid the husband. So you can imagine that today, my goodness.
The wife came free. I can remember my first youth hostel I ever went to. I was given, I think I must have fallen out with a warden, and they gave me the chore of trying to clean a roasting tin that don't think had been cleaned for something like 30 years. And I was 17, you know.
You obviously upset them somehow.
I can't believe that. But one of the things that one of the parts of your book, come on to your book, that interested me was, and I think, well, one of the things that somebody said was that you know, that the hills themselves actually have changed very little over the sort of decades that you've been writing, which just almost certainly true. But I think what has changed quite dramatically, actually, and it is continuing to evolve, really, is our relationship to the hills. Do you agree with that?
Yes, I would agree with that. Yes, I think the pandemic has largely contributed to that.
Yes.
I think one of the silver linings of the pandemic is the fact that we now kind of recognize that nature and the natural world is actually important to us. That we need spaces where we can, you know, just allow our minds to roam, and we have a bit of sort of freedom, mental freedom as well as physical freedom. And I think the pandemic has really emphasized that. So I think, you know, we're seeing so many people coming to the Scottish countryside now, and, you know, it is creating some problems.
Yeah.
But I think it is, you know, we can solve these problems, I think, by education. And the very fact that people are coming to the countryside and camping and all the things that, you know, some people frown on. But I think it's wonderful. I think it's great to have this reintroduction, because it's only when we understand the natural world, and it's only when we understand that we actually are part and parcel of that natural world, we'll begin to, you know, look after it. And by goodness, our world really needs us looking after it.
It certainly does. So, I mean, yeah. I mean, you know, I think we have to find a way of sharing, I think, the landscape. And that's not always been easy. It's not always been an easy thing to do. I mean, well, one of the things also, I think, that I felt when you were writing about some of the characters you met, and I don't know that those characters kind of exist anymore. The mountaineering world, you talked about, well, notably you talked about, I didn't realise this, but you obviously knew Benny Rothman, who was very instrumental in the 1930s in organising the trespass on Kinder Scout Hill in Derbyshire, and really, really fighting and sacrificing his liberty even to actually get some rights to walk. Incredible character.
The wonderful thing about Benny Rothman is he wasn't even a hill walker. He wasn't a rambler. He was a professional agitator for the Communist Party. Which I find, because I remember going to see him in his house in Manchester. We were making a television program with him, and I was almost kind of, you know, worshiping at his feet. He was this great hill walking, and he said to me, "I was never a walker myself. You know, I couldn't really understand." How people get, so I was an agitator. I went there to stir things up, and he most certainly did, and very, very successfully. And he's still a hero of mine, walk it or not.
That's right. I didn't realise he was. I knew that he was a committed socialist, and that he spent his entire life really campaigning for the lives of for the rights of working class people. But I thought also he was a committed walker, which obviously he wasn't.
No, but I mean, you started off by saying we don't see these characters anymore, and we don't even see them in politics anymore. And there was a time, you know, I'm thinking of people like Tony Benn and going back, and others who were very much committed socialists and sounded like committed socialists, but committed socialists seems to have become extinct now. We don't hear from these people very much at all. There are one or two here still in Scotland, but I'm not even sure what parties they represent anymore. So, yeah, we've kind of moved on. But you're right. I mean, there were a lot of characters and a few. I was delighted. I was giving a talk the other night in Arbroath, and the lady came and approached me and said, "I'm Sid Scroggie's daughter."
Sid was
a wonderful, wonderful character who was blinded and lost a leg during the Second World War. Before that, he was one of Scotland's finest climbers. And he stood in a landmine and became blinded and lost a leg. And when he came home from the war, he put an advert in the Dundee Courier saying he needs someone to take him to the hills. He needs a pair of eyes to take him to the hills. And guide dogs need not apply. I can't remember all the words, but it was a wonderful, well put together advert. And he was the sort of guy you could walk along with in the countryside, and you would never realise he was blind, you know. You would say, "Oh, that there's a ring ousel just over there. Oh, what a beautiful bird!" And you'd describe it. In fact, the first time I met him, John, it was quite interesting. I was going to interview him for a radio program I was doing at the time. And I had phoned him up and said, I know you live just north of Dundee, but can you tell me where exactly? And I'll come there and meet you there. And he said, well, I live in a place called Strathmartin, just north of Dundee. Come into the village and ask anybody where the blind old bugger lives. So I said, well, that's fine. So when I drove into Strathmartin, I saw this old guy out digging his garden, and I shouted, can you tell me where Sid Scroggy lives? And he says, aye, are you McNeish? I said, aha. And he says, all right, I'm Sid. He said, what to do is just reverse your car into the driveway. I'll guide you. I said, fine. So I was reversing, and this guy behind me said, you know, right hand down a bit. And I suddenly remembered he was blind. But he was like that. He was that sort of, he was a wonderful character, and a great climber in his day, and something of a poet. He wrote a lot of poetry.
Oh, and really?
He wrote one book, which was kind of based on the Larry Grew, which was a fantastic book published by the Scottish Mountaineering Club a number of years ago. But yeah, it was a real joy the other night to meet his daughter and just kind of reminisce a wee bit about Sid.
I mean, I think perhaps in some ways, maybe this is getting off the track a little bit, but maybe because of the kind of media that we're all subject to and social media, except we've all become a bit amorphous, you know, because I don't know if I remember years ago, the climbing community was very open to all sorts of different people. And a lot of the guys who used to go climbing with or populate mountaineering clubs or whatever were the sort of people who wouldn't really be accepted in the local golf club or anything like that, you know. But yeah. Mountaineering gave them a home. Do you think? I don't know.
Yeah, I've got a bit in the book about exactly that. And it's I spent my teenage years as an athlete, as a long jumper. I became an international long jumper when I was 18. And so my teenage years were very much about discipline and training, going to bed, you know, not going to discos and living a very clean life and not drinking and all this kind of stuff. And when I was about 20, 21, and I had been going to the hills and doing a wee bit of hill walking and enjoyed it. But when I was about 20, 21, I had a number of injuries, and I thought, well, basically it was the Commonwealth Games in Edinburgh, and I hoped to get in that team, and I didn't make it. Mm-hmm. So I was a bit shattered. And I thought, this is the time for me to make a decision. It's either the hills or athletics. And I chose the hills because of the people that I met on the hills. I met guys who were every bit as committed and fit and strong as the athletes that I'd been training with in my teenage years. But they had a wildness to them as well. They knew how to enjoy themselves. They really just attracted me. They were the sort of people that I just didn't come across during my athletics years as a teenager. And I just loved these people. You know, I just loved going out with them. I then joined the Lowman Mountaineering Club and met a whole bunch of characters. it was tremendous. But, you know, I go back to this. But the thing is, we've kind of come full circle now. We've kind of gone through that where you have a few beers at night time in the pub, then you're going to have a great day in the hill the next day. Nowadays, particularly the climbers, are like those athletes that I trained with in the 60s. They're disciplined. They eat the proper foods. They're vegans. They're very, very committed. And it's great. I can understand that. But they've lost that wildness. They've lost the characters. And I couldn't even tell you who some of the leading climbers are these days. I've no idea. There's certainly no Don Whelans amongst them, no Doug Scotts, no Chris Bonington's. Look at the Hill game. You know, there still are characters. There's people like you and me. We're still around. Chris Townsend, one or two others. You know, the characters are still there. But maybe we're just too old now and we don't kind of recognise them in the same way.
Maybe that's right. That's right. I don't know. One of the things you also touched on in the book, which interested me as well, and I get it's about, I think, a change in our relationship with the hills, really, is, you know, I keep going back, I suppose, to when I started. But when I started, there were lists of hills to tick and there were climbs to do and routes to get up and things like that. And that seemed to be an end in itself. And if you sat round the mothy fire, as I've done on a few occasions, the years ago, nature and what was actually happening to the landscape probably wouldn't have been discussed hardly at all. But that's very much changed now, I think.
Yeah, thank goodness for that. I noticed that a while ago, young Alex Roddy, who There's a lot of stuff in the Great Outdoors magazine now. A very fine writer himself.
Yes.
He was. I think he was doing the digital edition of the Great Outdoors. I think something like that. But he said somebody wrote to him and said, "Could you lay off all this wildlife stuff?" Great Outdoors is an outdoors magazine. It's not a wildlife magazine.
Yeah.
And he was quite shocked by that. And it made me think back to my time editing the Great Outdoors. And I had a lot of that kind of stuff. And a lot of letters from people saying, if we want to know about wildlife, we'll buy a wildlife magazine. And please keep off politics. We're not interested in politics. They just didn't want to know about politics. And I like to think in those days, the Great Outdoors was a bit of a campaigning magazine, campaigning for hill walkers. An awful lot of people say we don't like. And of course, the problem, the main problem is my bosses, the advertising managers and the publishers, they didn't like publishing stuff about politics because there was no revenue in it. They couldn't get advertising revenue in the back of it. So they were never too happy about me going down that route. But I did it anyway, because I think it's important.
It is important. I think the more you begin to understand the landscape of the hills and the changes that they're going through, you begin to realize that the hills have really been abused over the years. And we're walking largely in a green desert. But that's changing. But that's necessarily, I think, a political concept. It's about who manages, who controls the land. I don't know if you agree with that.
Yes, I do, very much so. And I think we're beginning to understand that we've made a mess of things in the past. I wrote my first feature on climate change in 1978. And
really?
We haven't really moved on much further since then. How we look after the planet. When we look at it in terms of Scottish countryside, we still have thousands of acres of grouse moors, which is monoculture. It's all about shooting grouse to the detriment of everything else. But it's something I've kind of struggled a wee bit in recent years, John, because just like you, I was brought up with the hills when they were bare. Bare of trees. I'm used to that. I love the open spaces. I love that feeling of openness and bareness and if I can use this overused word, wilderness. Mm-hmm. But now it's almost trendy to say, "Oh yes, it's a nice view, but wouldn't it be better if it was covered in trees?" And I think yes, in some instances it would be, but in other instances, I hate to think of the crone covered in trees. It's not going to happen. But there are some areas where actually. I don't really want trees. So I think like all of these things, we all have different opinions on it. But I think there's a general feeling now that we really have to do something about these thousands of acres of grouse moors that are not really helping anybody or anything. And we have to learn to treat our planet much, much better than we have in the past.
Yeah, I think that I'm beginning to see little saplings or little roots change bursting through in various areas like that. It felt for years and years like that these huge sporting estates where they stalk deer and there'd be the big house and the staff and that was the way it was always going to be. But it feels to me now as though, with what's happening in places like Glenfeshey, where it's being rewilded and the trees are coming back, that it is really starting to change. It's not everywhere, but there is, things are changing now, I think.
Yes, I think you're correct. And I think what is quite sad is the fact it's taken someone from Denmark to show us the way forward. But having said that, my great friend and erstwhile neighbour here, the late Dick Bulhari, saw a similar opportunity when he worked for the Nature Conservancy Council down on Craigmeggie, and the old birch woods, they were dying, and the Nature Conservancy put the estate up for sale, and he managed to talk them out of it, and he said what we should really do is reduce the deer numbers. We'll put lots of turnips in the fields and we'll tempt the deer down, and then we'll lock them in and then we'll cart them off in lorries and take them elsewhere. Bring deer now. So they didn't actually kill an awful lot of deer. But simply by doing that, and removing the sheep, of course, simply by doing that, the regeneration in those birch woods on Craigmeggie have been miraculous, miraculous. You can see growth now right up Coriarder, almost right up to the Clochan. Yeah. It's absolutely wonderful. And of course, the same thing's happened in Glenfeshey. I took some photographs. One is in the new book, Only 20 years or so after they started, you know, after Anders Povlsen started rewilding the Glenfeshie, and the results have been absolutely astonishing.
Yes.
So if you just leave things alone, reduce the deer to sustainable numbers, we don't have to get rid of them, just completely, and they can still go and shoot deer if they want to.
Yeah.
But reduce them to sustainable numbers, and what you'll get is bigger, healthier deer.
Yes.
And a much greater ecosystem, a much more diverse ecosystem. And it's fantastic that we're seeing it in places like Feshi. And I think you're right. I think other landowners, other land managers are beginning to recognize the value in that.
Yes, it is changing. And so what I'm really encouraged by and amazed to see, delighted to see really, the reintroduction of the beaver. I think that's a fantastic thing that you know, an animal that hasn't been around for 400 years is back.
Yeah, it's wonderful, but why didn't the Scottish government get it right? Instead of handing out licenses to farmers to shoot them if they feel that they're affecting the land, you know, why not say, well, we'll capture them, capture these beavers and move them somewhere where they won't do any harm? But I think it's so typical of the Scottish government, you know, they kind of do it half-heartedly and do half something. And where the beavers are thriving, we can see the differences already. It's fantastic.
Yeah.
And I hope the next step is lynx.
Absolutely.
It's taken long enough for beavers to be reintroduced, so God knows how long it will take for lynx. And as for wolves, well, forget it. It's not going to happen in my lifetime.
No, I'm afraid. We may live long enough to see lynx. I doubt that we'll certainly live long enough to see wolves, you know?
I don't think so. The land managing side of things is still too strong, still too influential. It's going to be difficult. And another thing is, we need people shouting about these things.
Yeah.
We don't have a lot of people in Scotland shouting about these things, you know, from access right through to species introduction. Pardon me. Big picture, Scotland is doing a fantastic job, but they're kind of limited in what they can do. They're kind of limited to social media. But we really need the likes of Scottish Natural Heritage or Nature Scot, whatever they call themselves now, taking a lead in this. And instead of being an organisation that is there to do what the government tells them to do, we really need to go back to what the Nature Conservancy Council was before they made it SNH, and actually start looking after this. In fact, I'd quite like to see, I don't know if you're aware of this, John, but Scottish Natural Heritage came from two organisations, the Countryside Commission for Scotland and Nature Conservancy Scotland. NCC looked after the birds and the beasts and reintroductions and all that kind of stuff. The Countryside Commission for Scotland looked after us, the people. There's about footpaths and long distance trails and how, you know, the people and the environment. And I'd like to see that split happen again. I think we've got far too many natural history boffins working for that is Scottish Natural Heritage or Nature Scot now, and not enough people with an interest in the people who go to the hills, the people who go to the hills for well-being, the people who go to the hills for any number of reasons. So I'd like to see something like the Countryside Commission for Scotland set up again, and see that division between the two, because I'm not convinced that SNH really has our interests at heart. And we knew this during the access debate way back in the early noughties, from just from the Parliament was started in 1999 through to 2003. Gosh, it was hard work with Scottish Natural Heritage at the time. They weren't all that keen on the idea of a freedom to roam. So I would like to see that split again, and something there that was kind of dedicated to the interests of those of us who go to the countryside and the hills and mountains.
Yeah. Well, I think it's important that there are more people going into the hills. Well, what we've talked a bit about, a lot about, obviously, what I liked about your book was that it's kind of a ramble through memory. Yeah, and that's exactly. Kind of what memory's like. It's not this solid sort of well-connected thing. I'm always remembering bits and pieces that I've forgotten. And that's kind of like, your book feels a bit like that. Oh, there's this, and there's this, and there's this, you know? Well, where do you think, see things going in the future? What if you were to write this book in 10 years' time, what do you think you'd be writing about?
Oh, well, I think we would see Highlands and Islands Enterprise still on Cairngorm with companies going bust and still insisting on potential for skiing on Cairngorm. I think we'd still see the Scottish government with no real idea about nature conservation or that side of things, giving massive grants to companies to plant millions of trees and building miles and miles of deer fencing with no public access points. I still think we'll see these things happening. But on the other side, I'm pretty sure now that it's been introduced to people, we will see lots more people appreciating the need for us to look after these wild places, yes, to look after the natural world. It was the great Aldo Leopold, and you probably heard this quote so many times, saying that when we treat the land as a commodity belonging to us, which is kind of really how we have been treating the land, yes, as a commodity, yeah, we will abuse it. But if we treat it as a community to which we also belong, you know, along with the birds and the beasts and the rocks and the flowers and the trees and human beings, we're all part of that community. And when we see it as that, we'll tend to love and respect it. And I think a lot more people now are beginning to see their role in that natural community and realise that we really do have to look after it. Because if we don't, it's quite simple, along with climate change, the spinning planet will simply slough us off and yeah, carry on itself. It'll heal itself and it'll carry on, but
yeah,
without us.
Yeah, we have to. I think there are a lot of, in some ways it's strange because COVID, which in many ways is a man-made phenomenon anyway, yeah, has actually changed our relationship with the outdoors, I think, quite dramatically. Mm. I mean, I wrote my first book about 10 years ago now, The Last Hill Walker, and that one, and I'd come back to the hills after a bit of a sort of absence, and I was really surprised to see that most people, you know, who were on the hills were of my age. And I didn't see young people on the hills, but I'm really pleased to say that, you know, if I wouldn't write that book now, because there are so many people cycling and paddleboarding and pack rafting and doing all kinds of different things and people now, I think, who value the hills.
I think you're right, John. And the wonderful thing about it, and again, I've mentioned this in the book, is that people tend not to specialize these days. When I went to the hills, I was a climber. First, and I joined the Lumber Marine Club, and we were climbers. We looked down on hill walkers.
Yes.
We always prefixed the word Munro bagger with the word dirty Munro bagger.
Quite right.
We were all specialists. But nowadays, you'll see cars going up the A9 with a canoe in the top, and you know there's the hiking boots aside. There's a mountain bike in the back of the car.
Yeah, exactly.
Maybe a paddleboard. You know, so people are into all of these things now, and I think that's very, very healthy.
So do I. So anyway, listen, it's been great talking to you. And it's sort of, your book kind of took me on a little bit of a journey, I must admit, reading. I mean, it brought back a lot of the kind of memories that have been, of the hills that have been kicking around. And it really brought home to me how valuable it is. And I'm certainly looking forward to re-cementing my relationship with the mountains again, you know.
That's great, John. And you know, just as a wee addendum to, you know, the people going with the paddle boards and the mountain bikes, there's even people going to the hills now with hot tents. You know that?
I can't believe that, Cameron.
Yeah. Wood burning stoves in them and everything. My goodness.
It's a bloody disgrace, isn't it?
Unbelievable, isn't it?
I've heard some blokes written a book about it as well. Anyway,
I know, it's a great book. It's a great book. I love the original thinking in it. So all strength to you, John.
Thanks very much. It's been lovely talking to you, Cameron. Thanks very much, Ben.
Thank you, mate. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, I hope you enjoyed that little podcast. I suppose Cameron has very strong views about some of the things about our countryside and our landscape. If you agree with him, if you don't agree with him, do message me. I'd be happy to hear what you've got to say. If you enjoyed the show, do give us a little follow on whatever platform you use for your podcasts. And just to let you know that I'm hoping to interview fairly shortly Brian Hall about his book High Risk, which is about the sort of golden age of Himalayan climbing between in the 70s and 80s, when there were some really radical routes done in the Himalayas. I hope we get Brian in the next few days, so his podcast should come out next weekend. I do hope you've enjoyed listening to me. I've been John Burns, and please come again.